I'll show you politics in America. Here it is, right here. I think the puppet on the right shares my beliefs. I think the puppet on the left is more to my liking. Hey, wait a minute. There's one guy holding up both puppets. Shut up. Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control.
Read my lips.
Just send your cash.
There has never been so many lies, so much deception.
Doesn't anyone notice this? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
Please clap.
It's time for the Mike Madison Show, a new breed of conservative talk. Now, here's your host, Mike Madison.
Showtime! Woo!
All right, good morning. Welcome to the Mike Madison Show here at 103.9 WYAB. I am your host, Mike Madison, here weekdays 9 to 11 o'clock. Next hour, 10 o'clock, we'll have Michael Casti on again. This could be interesting. I've met Michael Casti, met his campaign manager, spent some time. Michael was talking to a large group of constituents. I was kind of off to the side and ended up talking to his campaign manager. Was pretty impressed with him and certainly liked Michael as I talked to him. I think that a lot of people here at the station, I think a lot of people in central Mississippi and at least in the WYAB bubble are certainly looking for something different than Michael Guest, somebody that's a little bit more little anti-establishment up there. A lot of people that I know personally are really kind of sick and fed up with the status quo in Washington, D.C., and Michael Guest appears to be kind of one of the status quo guys. So there's a lot of energy for moving in a different direction. So we will talk to Michael Casti next hour. He's got his platform that he's running on. We'll examine that. And then be honest with you, I've got some questions for him. And we've told him up front, the libertarian's kind of hard to please. I'm chronically unhappy with even large parts of what conservatives cheer for constantly because libertarians are really about true freedom in the United States. And so I've got some kind of freedom-based questions I'll ask. It'll be, I think, an interesting conversation. I'm not really interested in challenging Casti in any way. I'm just kind of taking his temperature for how it is. I'm fully believe I will head to the polls tomorrow and pull a lever for him. I think that I'm not a huge term limits guy because I believe that just shows we're just lazy. To me, it's almost like another, we need the government to do this for us. We just can't get rid of an incumbent. We got to have the government stop them so that we can just vote for them three times and then be done and have the government tell us we need another one. And, you know, these establishment parties, both Republicans and Democrats, will just give you a conveyor belt of cutout candidates. People need to get energized behind challengers. You don't need term limits. You can actually do it yourself. I think this is a learned helplessness in the populace. I understand there are people I would not like to see on Capitol Hill that would be long since gone with term limits, and that would be great. But I do also believe that if Nancy Pelosi was not there, then somebody just like Nancy Pelosi would be holding that seat because the Democrats will give you another candidate, a cutout candidate. We always have the ability to do it. Anyway, I think a lot of people are ready for a change in the 3rd District here in Mississippi, so we'll give Michael Casti a chance on a libertarian show to tell us what he believes and how he'd would approach the job. Quotes of the day today. I ran across this one that took me down a thread. There's a Twitter account called Being Libertarian, and I loved this one. It says, "Dear government, after a nearly 40-year-long war on drugs, you can't keep drugs off the streets. You can't keep drugs out of elementary schools. You can't even keep drugs out of federal prison. Yet you want me to disarm myself and trust that you can keep guns from criminals." I think they make a good point. I mean, even to a larger point, it's been very interesting. I've talked a little bit about the fact that the Libertarian Party has become libertarian again. The Libertarian Party, for some period of time now, was pretty well, what I estimate was really hijacked when nobody was paying attention by some wokesters, some social justice warriors in the upper echelons of the Libertarian Party. It has been taken over now by the Ron Paul types in the Libertarian Party, and it's quite interesting. I went and checked out their Twitter account. Here are some tweets from the Libertarian Party now. Liberty Lockdown, this is a A guy does a podcast, Clint Russell. He said, when your nation is suffering severe inflation, you need only ask the libertarians how it arose. Instead, people turn towards the arsonist and ask them how to stop the fire. The politicians and central banks cannot save you. They are equipped only with matches. Libertarian Party tweets out, the world is full of blood-soaked, war-making tyrants that must be stopped, say U.S. politicians who shamelessly back their own wars of aggression overseas. Following the tradition of Ron Paul and Harry Brown, we oppose their hypocrisy and promote military non-intervention. They go down through this. I encourage you to take a look at it. Oklahoma Libertarian Party says the president believes 18-year-olds are not old enough to, quote, defend their country, are old enough to defend their country with guns and military conflicts abroad, but not old enough to defend themselves at home. Now, here's one for the Second Amendment people. You don't realize it, but you've got a huge ally in the Second Amendment. We'll talk a little bit about gun control with Michael Cassidy, because Pat Toomey has come out and said, you know, he's looking for a compromise with the Democrats on gun control. That's your establishment Republican Party. If you're looking for people that are strong on the Second Amendment, you might want to take a look at the Libertarian Party. This is a Libertarian Party tweet. While the ruling class demands, quote, common sense gun control, unquote, we call for common sense machine gun decriminalization. As we see it, your preferred weaponry of choice isn't up for public debate. That is the Libertarian Party of view on the Second Amendment. And these things go on and on. It's just really, really nice to see the Libertarian Party has actually returned to being the Libertarian Party, which is about actual freedom. I also found this that I thought was kind of funny. Apparently, Hillary Clinton has weighed in on the gun control issue, and she sent out a tweet, just a short, succinct one. She said, no one actually needs an AR-15. Now, this is a woman constantly surrounded by security. She says, no one actually needs an AR-15. Being libertarian, tweeted back at her, no one actually needs Washington, D.C. And that's certainly true. Now, to give Hillary Clinton a slight amount of credit, she does understand firearms. Because Hillary Clinton has been perfectly fine killing people with just a handgun, just a double tap to the back of the head, and an AR-15 would just be overkill. So Hillary Clinton understands that you can use just two shots to take care of business. It appears that they have been doing it routinely. I'm going to take a break, come back. There's a guy, his name is Mark Spitznagel. He is known, he's a risk asset guy. He's a risk protection guy. That's his whole thing. He's an asset manager, but his whole thing is mitigating risks. And I'll tell you what he's worried about when we come back.
You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side.
Whenever we face financial difficulties like the 2008-2009 financial crisis, the people in power that create the problems always attempt to deflect any blame for these things by saying things like, we never could have seen this coming. They'll blame one thing or another. Right now we're seeing a lot of blame on Putin, a lot of blame on COVID. Of course, it wasn't COVID the disease. It was the reaction to COVID by these exact same people that caused supply chain issues. Janet Yellen the other day said she underappreciated what inflation was going to do, but she blamed COVID. She blamed Russia. We never could have seen these things coming. In the world that I travel in and the people that I respect, they always see these things coming. They shout it from the rooftops for years, sometimes decades, and then when it happens, most people believe that everything was going along great, and then we had this external force come in that nobody could have anticipated, and that's why we're having a problem. It's not the case. So I like to highlight some of the voices that see these things coming. They know exactly what's going on, and some of them are professionals. This is what they do for a living. Mark Spitznagel is paid to be prepared for when the market's weakest links are exposed in a big way. Right now, the Universa Investments founder, whose fund aims to protect clients during black swan events, meaning these big direction-changing events that come out of the blue, seemingly. Right now, the Universa Investments founder, whose fund aims to protect clients during Black Swan events, says the financial system is most vulnerable to, quote, the greatest credit bubble of human history. Spitznagel said, quote, if this credit bubble ever pops, it's going to be the most catastrophic market failure that anyone has ever read about. But let's hope that doesn't happen. He said, we've gotten ourselves into a tough spot. Spitznagel insists he's not a doom and gloomer. He's long been critical of central banks keeping interest rates near zero or even negative, which he says has propped up asset values and encouraged excessive borrowing. His warning follows other cautious remarks this week from J.P. Morgan Chase. I don't know if you heard this. Jamie Dimon told investors to prepare for an economic hurricane. And even Goldman Sachs, the vampire squid, President John Waldron, said he's seen unprecedented number of shocks and expects tougher times, tougher economic times ahead. So these people see what's going on. Now, I would submit to you that if J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs are coming out and warning you about tough times, they're already on the other side of the market. I've said it many times. They're going to leave the retail investor, the mom and pops out there, those of you constantly contributing to your 401k through automatic contributions. God love you for setting aside your own money, taking responsibility for your own retirement. But you're going to be left holding the bag. These big boys might already be out of the markets. So they're ready for them to pull the plug. I had an interesting experience on Saturday. I paid my first $5 plus in gas on Saturday. I believe it was around $5.24 a gallon. My car requires more than just the regular fuel, so I go up to the mid-grade fuel. I believe it was $5.25. It did give me something to talk to the person on the other side of the pump about. So there is that. Usually we don't have anything to really chat about, but you know, I pulled up, didn't pay any attention to the price. I knew it was going to be high. I knew it was going to hurt, but then I clicked on my choice of the mid-grade fuel and looked down at $5.24 and couldn't help. It's almost an involuntary thing. I believe my exact quote was, "Oh my God." And I got the attention of the person on the other side of the pump. We were both being mugged by our government at the same time. And so we had a little something to chat about. These high gas prices are bringing people together. Somebody I would not have had anything to talk about, but it's quite amazing. But I ran across this article, and there's a question that I've had for maybe a couple of decades now, particularly in light of if you remember when gas prices spiked during the financial crisis, we got up to around $4 a gallon for a brief period of time. Maybe it was only $3.50. I don't remember exactly now, but we had a big pop, and the price of a barrel of oil got to $150. Now, that is significantly higher than the price of a barrel now, yet gas prices were actually less than they are now. And I've long suspected and had trouble finding statistics on the relationship between the cost of a gallon of gasoline at the pump and a barrel of oil, but I finally have found a chart, and they have started to diverge pretty substantially. Typically, the price of a gallon of gasoline goes up and down with the price of a barrel of oil, but we've seen this year, particularly towards March of this year, that even when oil prices spiked and then came back down, gas prices did not come down with that spike in the same percentage. And one of the things being blamed on this is refining capacity. Refining margins now, the amount of money they make refining crude oil into gasoline has exploded to historically high levels in recent weeks, meaning refiners are making record amounts of profit. This is also exacerbated by lower supplies from places like Russia. But this was just interesting to me, and just follow me through this, see if this makes any sense to you. Chevron CEO Mike Wirth noted in an interview with Bloomberg TV that refining capacity being added is not easy, especially in the current environment. He said, you're looking at committing capital 10 years out. I guess this is how long it would take to actually invest in and complete a refining operation. He said, you're looking at committing capital 10 years out that will need decades to offer a return to shareholders in a policy environment where governments around the world are saying, we don't want these products. He said, we're receiving mixed signals in these policy discussions. And what he's talking about is that governments around the world are saying they're waging a war against fossil fuels, so should they invest in refining capacity if there's not going to be a demand for gasoline, if they're going to force us into this electric car, you know, away from fossil fuels. But he said in here, let me see if I can find the thing. He said, we haven't had a refinery built in the United States since the 1970s. And he went on to say, my personal view is there will never be another new refinery built in the United States. And one of the problems that we're seeing with gas prices is there's a bottleneck, which is reducing the available supply of gasoline. There's a bottleneck at the refinery level. Now, here's my question, and I had this back the last time this was really brought up, and it was when gas spiked. I think it was maybe in 2009, 2010, somewhere around there. There was a lot of talk back then about the fact we weren't building new refineries, yet at the time, oil companies and the refineries were making record profits. Now, I've owned a few businesses in my time, and I think I've got a fairly decent understanding of economics and the profit motive. If you're making record profits with very little refining capacity, why would you invest? And I believe the last figure I'd seen, now this may, of course, has probably increased, maybe doubled since then, but during the financial crisis when prices spiked, it was quoted that it cost about $1 billion to build a new refinery operation, about $1 billion. Now, that's still pretty good money, regardless of the fact we can send 53 of those over to Ukraine just on the keys, you know, a pen stroke of Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden. But $1 billion out in the real world is actually still a lot of money. If you were a refinery, refining company, if you were an oil company, why would you take and invest $1 billion so that your profit margins could actually contract, could go down? Again, these refineries, as I just told you right now, the refinery operations, the margins they are making on refining gasoline right now are at record highs. Why would you build more refining capacity? Why would you spend money? Why would you spend $1 billion, $2 billion to build new refineries if you're making record profits with fewer refineries? Nobody seems to be asking this question, but it seems quite logical. Is the reason that we haven't built a refinery in the United States since the 1970s strictly just... Now, I know there's a lot of regulations, and certainly the government makes building a refinery as hard as it possibly can, but we haven't had a war against gasoline since the 1970s in real earnest form. Now, they do set up a lot of regulations, but we know there's basically a regulatory scam in this country, which is some of these big companies, they love the regulations. Number one, it keeps competitors out of the market. But in this particular case, I kind of smell a rat where these regulations that have stopped us from building new refineries have actually locked in record profits for both the refining companies and the oil companies. They're not being hurt by lack of refining. They're selling every gallon of gasoline they can put out, and the refineries are making record profits. Why would you spend $1 billion out of pocket over the course of 10 years to make less money? It makes no economic sense. And I smell a little bit of a rat here. Methinks they doth protest too much, that maybe they have not actually purposefully built these and maybe even encouraged our politicians to put in these regulations to so they have some cover for saying, hey, look, we want to build, we really want to reduce our profits. We really want to give you cheaper gasoline. It's just that politicians have made it so hard for us to do that, and now they've gotten such, they have no clarity on what gasoline, where it will be in 10 years, if we're still really be using a lot of, or if this green stuff is going to be shoved down our throats. So, you know, their only choice right now is just to sit pat and continue to make record profits. That's essentially what the argument is, as I see it. I think this is a bit of a scam, to be honest with you. And we're not going to see anything different anytime soon. So I think my cherry being popped on Saturday for paying over $5 a gallon is just the beginning. We were talking last week about the fact that gasoline stations now are having to make changes to their boards make some technological upgrades to be able to make double-digit gas prices. This is what's been done to us. When I come back, I want to... Joe Biden gave a speech last week that was... It was truly incredible. It was something to behold in the lies, the total disregard for any level of truth that is so apparent to the vast, vast, vast majority of Americans. I would say probably about 95% of Americans couldn't have believed a word that came out of this man's face, yet he said it straight into a microphone in front of all of us. And I got one huge prediction wrong. Boy, did I missed one. I missed one. I'll fess up to it when we come back.
Stick around. I need to feel your touch. I need your understanding. I need your love so much.
All right, we are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB. Next hour, I'm going to have congressional candidate Michael Cassidy on as he attempts to do the unthinkable and unseat an establishment Republican here in the state of Mississippi. It can be done if enough people actually get engaged, enough people get sick and tired of being sick and tired. Challengers can actually win. It's happened around the country. It'd be interesting to see if Mississippi can finally wake up and maybe make some changes, enact your own term limits if you're dissatisfied with who is currently in office. So we'll talk to Michael Cassidy. I will have questions for him. I don't want to use the term warning, but we did let him know I've got questions. Libertarians are not always satisfied with conservative talking points. And so there'll be some questions that probably aren't asked on other radio shows. I just kind of want to find out where Michael Cassidy stands on some of the issues that are important too. I would imagine if there are libertarians out there, many of them may listen to this show, so we'll get a chance to see if we've got somebody that at least tilts that way. I believe there's great value in libertarian-leaning Republicans. Some of the greatest congressmen and senators that have served in the Congress in modern history have been libertarian-leaning Republicans. I'm wide open to that. So that's always a That's always a potential bright spot. I missed it. It came and went. May of 2022 came and went. That was when I had decided or predicted that Joe Biden would be taken out of office. I did start to worry, you know, during the course of this year as I saw how unpopular Kamala Harris was and how completely unsuited she is for any public-facing presence. She's just not capable of stringing together any coherent thoughts. She's wildly unsmart and unimpressive. And so I did worry, well, maybe they need to keep Joe there. But I just felt like, you know, to get him in there as as a place setter and then pull some hanky-panky and maybe we'd end up with a Hillary presidency. But I had May picked for the date that Joe Biden would leave office, and obviously I've missed it. He made it. There were some encouraging signs there for a little while. He's obviously got tremendous cognitive decline, wildly unpopular heading into midterms that the Democrats are scared to death they're going to lose in mass. So I thought maybe they would mount a coup against this man and go ahead and retire him, but they did not. So I will admit to it, I missed my prediction. We'll see how long he lasts. It still cracks me up. I see articles, will Joe Biden run for a second term? I think the answer is a solid no. I don't think he makes it out of his first term either alive or in office. But we'll see. Obviously, I've been wrong. I can be wronger. But I can't be more wronger than Joe Biden is. He gave a speech last week, and some of this is some of the most incredible things I've ever heard come out of a president's mouth. And that says a lot because politicians lie. Presidents tell some of the biggest lies. But it's usually at least some level of spin. It's some level of pandering, not just demonstrably false to everybody's eyes lies, like what Joe Biden said last week. Here's one of the big ones.
Since I took office, families are carrying less debt. Their average savings are up. A recent survey from the Federal Reserve found that more Americans feel financially comfortable than any time since the survey began in 2013.
Okay. This is so, do I need to even roll out the statistics? I've been covering these stories for a few weeks now as the credit numbers and the personal savings rate have been reported on, because the personal savings rate since about the first quarter of 2021 has just been really, let's just be honest with it, since the stimmies stopped, since the government checks stopped, when the government checks started in 2020, Trump's final year, when the government decided to print up 20% of all the money that had ever been created during Trump's final year, the savings rate shot through the moon. There was nowhere for you to go spend your money except online. You couldn't go off. You couldn't go on vacation. You couldn't spend money on a bunch of different things. And the government sent out a bunch of money. So the savings rate went up. And if you've ever seen that chart, it is just a rocket ship up to a peak, peak, peak. And then it starts falling again as people start spending their stimmies over the next coming months. It peaked again. Savings rate peaked again in early 2021. When? When the stimmies went out again. This one wasn't as high because they didn't have the PPP loans out as well. And then for a couple of months, people had record savings. Well, it wasn't record. It wasn't as high as it was in 2020. And then as the stimmy checks wore out, savings rates have been falling through the floor, and they are now lower than the chart I'm looking at now. With Federal Reserve numbers, the savings rate is lower than it was in 2016 or any time since. Joe Biden just told you people have less debt and more savings than ever. The credit card debt chart is the exact opposite of the personal savings, and I've reported on it now, where Americans are carrying record amounts of credit card debt. Now, this is not only it, this is one of those things. I don't believe you need to hear those statistics to know things are not going well. Joe Biden just told you Americans have never felt more comfortable financially than they do right now. Now, I will say this, to give him just the slightest little bit of credit, he may not know what the hell he's talking about. I mean, he is reading a teleprompter, someone has put these words in front of him, and Joe Biden has not walked an inch in the average American's shoes in his entire life, near as I can tell. I don't know we've had a president, maybe since Jimmy Carter, maybe Carter at one point was a normal person. Jimmy Carter might have known what it was like to be a regular person. We've not had any other presidents that have known what it's like to be just a regular guy in decades. And Joe Biden is certainly no exception to that. This is a problem. I would say that only a few, even in our Congress, have probably been, at least in the leadership. Now, there probably are some rank and file, you know, the names we don't really know because they don't attract a lot of attention. They don't get the microphone that often. There are a lot of Congress critters of whom we really know very little about, but of the big players, the people driving policy, the people running committees, these people, I doubt very many of them have even been to a grocery store in years and years. Can anybody actually imagine Nancy Pelosi pushing a shopping cart down the aisles of a grocery store? And the longer they are in D.C., the further they get removed from ordinary people stuff. Joe Biden may actually not know, because he is mentally impaired and he has never lived a normal American life, because he's been a parasite on the system, catered to and funneled millions and millions of taxpayer dollars at this guy through his salary and his benefits and his armed security and his positions. He doesn't know what being an average American is even about. He can't even associate with that. I don't know what it's like to be a Korean immigrant to Southern California, because I've never lived that life. I don't know Korean traditions. I know nothing about what that must feel like to come on a boat from Korea and try to set up life. That's how far Joe Biden is removed from the average American experience. So he may actually not know what's going on in this country, and he's reading his teleprompter. The fact that that was put into a teleprompter in front of him is stunning itself. Of course, Joe Biden also believes, because I'm sure he has no understanding of economics right now, if he ever did, but he certainly doesn't now in the capacity that he has mentally. So, of course, he has a reason that if any of you don't believe that you are in the best shape you've ever been, then there is somebody to blame.
The two challenges on the minds of most working families are prices at the pump and prices at the grocery store. Both of these challenges have been directly exacerbated by Putin's war in Ukraine.
Of course.
The price of gas is up $1.40 since the beginning of the year when Putin began amassing troops at the Ukrainian border. This is a Putin price hike. Putin's war has raised the price of food because Ukraine and Russia are two of the world's major breadbaskets for wheat and corn, the basic product for so many foods around the world. Ukraine has 20 million tons of grain in storage right now, and it's been in storage since the last harvest. Normally, that would have already been exported into the world market. But because of Putin's invasion and blockade of the port on which they could take that grain out for the rest of the world, it's not.
Now, of course, there are charts as well that show the CPI. It's called the Urban Consumers Year-Over-Year CPI. Now, I don't want to describe this chart, but the beginning of 2021... got a little chart of when Joe Biden took office. Now, I don't let you don't think for a second I'm falling into the trap of this all being Bidenflation. This was coming regardless of whether Trump was reelected, Joe Biden was elected, Tulsi Gabbard was. This inflation was coming. It's a consequence of money printing. Joe Biden did not on his first day step into office and somehow, as bad as he is, somehow create all this inflation. No, this was coming regardless of who was in the White House. But to his point where he tells you that this is all the Putin price hike, if you look at a chart of inflation from the day he took office until the day that Putin invaded, we were well on our way. Inflation rate had gone from a recognized, and again, these numbers are juiced. We know it's much higher than these, but even the official rate, Joe Biden started his term at around 1.7% inflation. And by the time Putin amassed his troops and invaded Ukraine, inflation was already about 7.6% before Putin did a single thing. Joe Biden started at about 1.7%. By the time Putin invaded, it was already at over 7.5% inflation. This might be a little more difficult for people to understand because we have short-term memories. Now, what is the solution that Joe Biden has, the Democrats are going to have? And you can rest assured, in an election year, I can guarantee you, stimmies are coming back. The exact thing that caused the inflation that we have, money printing, too big of a government, is going to be their prescription to do this so that they can maybe possibly limp their way through something that is not a catastrophe for them at the ballot box in November.
If food and gas prices are going to be elevated by Putin's price hike, one way we can make things a little better for families is by helping them save on other basic items their family needs on a monthly basis, like their utility bills, their internet bills, their prescription drug bills, and other costs like housing. My goal is to make sure that at the end of the month, families have a little more breathing room than they have now. For example, here's something we can do right now. Congress could help ease the cost for families right away by passing my clean energy investment proposal.
Okay, we know that doesn't work. I don't want to hear the rest of this, about a 3-minute clip. So the government is going to get more involved. And when the government gets more involved in these things, it means they print more money. They want you to have a little bit more breathing room than you have now. The problem is that people do not understand that government is the ones that sucked all of the air out of the room in the first place. And they will turn to this government and pray for another check or some induced relief from the government that will actually exacerbate inflation going forward. This was quite a speech. It really was. I recently covered one where I said it was maybe the worst speech I'd ever heard from the President of the United States? Well, Joe Biden can constantly set the bar a little bit lower, and he's done it with this one. If his approval rating was not in the floor, I can't imagine the number of Americans who listen to this man tell them, you've never done better than you are right now. Federal Reserve says so. That takes balls to stand in front of the American people right now and tell them how great they're doing. I'll be right back.
All right, when we
we come back next hour, we'll have congressional candidate Michael Cassidy on. We'll talk about his platform, and I've got some libertarian-leaning questions for him, so we'll see how that works out. Anyway, I'm looking forward to that. I certainly admire him for coming on the show and answering. He knows he's going to get some questions that will be outside of the mainstream, probably. So we'll do that next hour. This is something I've been kind of wondering for a little while. I guess I'll just tuck it in right here. I ran across a video yesterday. It drew my attention because it was said something like, there is still kindness in the world. I click on that kind of crap. I'll just tell you right now, I do, because I'm looking for it. Our society has become so sick and hostile and angry, and I know there's goodness in there. I talk about it all the time. I'm a big fan of people. I'm a bad... I don't care for groups. As soon as people join big groups, something happens to them. I like individuals. But I saw this video, and it was a handicapped person trying to get across a busy street. And there's just cars going. Two crutches. Looked to be an elderly person. It's a camera's pretty far away. A fire truck pulls up next to him and then hops across the median and goes perpendicular to the traffic to stop traffic on the side of the road where this handicapped person was trying to get across. They block the traffic. They get several of the firemen, and I believe this may have even been an international thing. Didn't really look like an American fire truck. But they block the traffic and help the handicapped person get across the road. And then they all get back in the truck, and they back up, and they go on their merry way. I have wondered for a while, are firemen the last honorable government employees left? Firemen, and I'm almost always looking for corruption at every nook and cranny. Now, I believe, you know, if you want to take it down to a level, then I'd love to have fire departments that are privately done. Everybody pays a fee to have their house protected for fire. I know that may not be popular with a lot of people, but I just believe the government does everything so inefficiently that it would be better. But let's just, for the sake of, I mean, I'm fine. I like having fire protection for a home. But is this the last profession with really even a shred of service to the community without offsetting ritual abuses? When you look across the landscape of government, and understand, I'm a libertarian. I oppose government at basically every level. School boards have obviously sold their souls for money. They mask your children for grants. No regard for the health, for the science, for the damage that it does to children and their development. They were getting grants. If they imposed these things on the children, they did that. This is not even mentioning the CRT stuff that is rolling from on top down. We've got petty tyrants in city halls just doing unbelievable things to their citizens in the name of COVID or medical marijuana. The police do absolutely heroic work when they aren't busy harassing and bossing people around, and they are also the enforcers of the system by these politicians, as I talked about last week. You know, there was one day, many years ago, there was one day where you could go out and have a beer as a 19-year-old, and you were perfectly within your rights, and then the law changed to 21, so the police would arrest that 19-year-old maybe just a few hours later, because politicians had decided that it was no longer legal for a 19-year-old to have a beer. The day before they were fine, the next day the police would have put them into a cage if they found them with a beer. The police enforce these rules. And don't get me started on the bureaucratic class of people who infest government at every level just to enforce the rules. But I think when I look out across the landscape, I think firemen, firewomen too, firefighters, maybe the last people with truly good intentions that just do positive things. Now, I'm open. You can contact me, Mike Madison, WYAB.com, and let me know if I'm missing something. I'm always open to the fact that maybe even the fire departments are are corrupt. But they may be the last government people left that have really kind of a benevolent existence within the framework of government. I'm a big fan of firemen. Also see a lot of firemen that take on second jobs to make extra money. That's kind of nice, too. When we come back, we'll talk to congressional candidate Michael Cassidy. Stick around.
I see the shadows on my face. People have told me I don't look the same. Maybe I lost weight. I'm
all right, we are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB. And today I am pleased to have on air with us Michael Cassidy, who is running against Michael Guest for the 3rd Congressional District. in the Republican primary and the election. The voting is tomorrow. I understand some voting has already taken place, but we are on the eve of the election. So, Mr. Cassidy, great to have you on. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, Mike, pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I admire your willingness to come to a show with a very hard-to-please libertarian. I'm not going to be happy until our government is about 5% of its current size, and I'm no fan of the establishment Republican Party as it stands right now, sickened by the Democrats. But, yeah, we have some different views than a lot of people. But I will say this. Some of the best congressmen in history have been libertarian-leaning Republicans, I think particularly of the great Ron Paul and currently Thomas Massie, who is a Republican congressman from Kentucky, who I am really a big fan of. He's a big freedom fighter, so I am open to a real freedom fighter Republican if they're up there to do that kind of work, and they actually may be our only hope at this point. So glad we'll have an opportunity to talk.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so just tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, where you're from, what your goal in running is, why you would wade into this nasty business of politics. That's the other thing, too. Yeah. Boy, God love you for wading into that morass. But so what's motivating you to run?
Yeah, before I get on that, there have been all sorts of weird things of politics and that just nasty things that you know, you'd hope weren't part of politics, but they are.
Yes.
And it's I got a pretty thick skin. I mean, I grew up, or my career was as a Navy pilot, and I still am today. And we're pretty hard on each other. I'll put it that way. And so all this stuff, like even any political attack on me, it's just water off a duck's back. So, about me. So, I was born in Annapolis, Maryland, when I was just real little, I see the Blue Angels flying overhead. The Naval Academy would do its commissioning ceremony, and the Blue Angels would always come. That's the Navy F-18 demonstration team. And then we moved to Arlington, for really where I grew up was in Arlington, Virginia. And that's where I was when September 11th happened. And Arlington's where the Pentagon is. And I had a classmate in high school that his dad was on that American Airlines flight that hit the Pentagon. And I was pretty mad at people at this group Al-Qaeda that did this to our country. And I said, man, I gotta do something, to back up my country. And I said, well, I'll join the military. And some people say it's opinion. I think it's more a fact. When I thought of what'd be the coolest thing to do in the military, and I thought flying jets off aircraft carriers.
No, I'll tell you what.
So that's what I signed up to do, and with some luck, because there's definitely just an element of chance with everything in military and assignments and a bit of hard work. I was able to get the opportunity to fly F-18s for a while and got stationed in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and then in 2016 I got stationed here in Mississippi to be an instructor pilot, and actually came through here about a decade ago as a student in Meridian. And so I came back to Mississippi in 2016 and then got off active duty in 2020, and I stuck around. I like where I live. I like the community there. I've got a good job as a contract pilot on the Navy base, so I still get to fly a lot, and it's again, Mississippi's nice. So I stuck around. I decided to get into politics. I don't have any political background at all. I've been certainly interested, and I follow politics a lot. The only candidate that I ever have given any money to in my entire life was Ron Paul.
There you go.
That was in, I think, in 2012 when I was a student here. And I think we had some bad weather, something for a couple of weeks in January, and so we weren't flying. And I started to pay a little bit more attention to the campaign. And I said, you know what? Maybe I'll give a little bit of money to Mr. Paul. And so I'm going to give a decent amount. Cause I was just fed up even then with the politics that we had. I didn't vote for, I've told everybody this. I didn't vote for McCain in 2008. I wrote in, a candidate. I couldn't vote for Obama, but I didn't vote for McCain cause I thought then that he was too neoconservative and I didn't like his softness on immigration.
Yeah.
And then in 2012, I saw, I either wrote in somebody again or I just didn't vote. I truly cannot recall in 2012 because, once again, could not vote for Barack Obama. And then, too, with Mitt Romney, I just saw him as this establishment slimy guy that really had the interests of only a few at hand. And, you know, he seems like just kind of like Michael Guest in a way, like seems like a perfectly nice person that I could go and have lunch with Mitt Romney or Michael Guest and everything would be just fine. But I did not see him as a that he would make a good president. And anyway, so I've been paying attention to politics for a while. And, you know, they ain't gotten better. It's just gotten...
Oh, man, I'm telling you.
That our country's path just keeps on... Like, we had a bit of hope. At least I know I had a bit of hope when Trump got elected. But, you know, there's so many more things that I wish had gotten done that didn't really get done. And a lot of things just kept on its same path. And I was worried about how things would be in the next decade or two decades. And similar to me... couple decades ago wanting to join the military to protect the country, that's why I got into the race for Congress, is that I am absolutely convinced that our current leadership, and that's both on the left and the right, is unwilling of making the right decisions to put our country back on the right track.
Yeah.
And I looked at some of the votes that my opponent, well, the current, it wasn't my opponent then, that our current Congressman Michael Guest had taken, and I saw some of the things that I saw wrong with a lot of the other leaders, more prominent people in the Republican Party, like this vote for January 6th Commission, the funding of Planned Parenthood. It's been since the election started, but the then giving $53 billion to Ukraine and just spending the taxpayers' money. It's not even the taxpayers' money at this point because it's the Federal Reserve printed money.
Right.
Like they're not even taking it out of our taxes. They're just making, what they're doing is they're printing money and it's taking it out of our income by, it's a shadow tax with
right.
inflation. So, anyways, that's a little bit of a kind of all over the place, but that's a little bit about me and why I decided to get in the race.
Well, I think, I've been kind of interested, but I've talked a lot about my background was 1990s being a Kool-Aid drinking, neocon, warmongering, Republican, Rush Limbaugh, you know, guy. And that's really how I got going. And then it was around, you know, started soon after the Iraq War started. I started looking at what exactly we were doing. Then I saw the Republicans passing Medicare Part D, which was the largest entitlement since LBJ. And I started thinking, it doesn't really feel to me like these guys that I've been cheerleading for. I mean, I remember laying in bed on Sunday mornings to catch Fox News Sunday, and Trent Lott would come on, and I would tell my wife, that guy is such a stud. And then I started to think, you know, what this political class, even on the right, is doing is not benefiting us. This is a disaster in the making, and you're right. It's gotten worse and worse. And so in about 2003, 2004, I pretty much said, I'm done with the Republican Party. I realized kind of my libertarian roots. And I've seen that now that has spread a lot, particularly over the last 5 to 10 years. And it's an interesting phenomenon. We have got both the left and the right are realizing the political class that they have created to rule us all is not serving any of us. And the left is very dissatisfied with the Nancy Pelosi's and the Chuck Schumer's. The right is very dissatisfied with the Mitch McConnell's, the John McCain, Mitt Romney types. And so it is time now to see people get engaged. One thing I keep saying is playtime's over. I mean, I think we are financially, we are a train wreck right now. Our government is too big. It is in every nook and cranny of our lives, and they cannot, we cannot afford that size of a government. And so it has gotten to the point now where we have got to make what I believe are some pretty drastic changes. Nibbling around the edges at this point is really not an option anymore.
Yeah, I agree with you. I absolutely agree.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's take a break and then come back. I wanted to get into some of your issues. One thing I wanted to talk about a little bit is gun control, because you talk about establishment Republicans. You know, the gun control is being debated right now as we speak up on Capitol Hill. This is going to be a big issue, and we certainly need. I know you're a supporter of the Second Amendment. I'm going to read a little bit about what Pat Toomey has said, because it frightens the hell out of me. So we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk about immigration, and then I'm going to get asked some libertarian-based questions as well, if you'll tolerate those.
Yeah, sure.
All right, great. We're talking to Michael Cassidy. He is challenging Michael Guest for the 3rd congressional seat here in the Republican primary, which takes place tomorrow. So, people, this is not going to be. This is a kind of an off-time election. Usually turnout is fairly low. This is a chance for people who want to see a change to take advantage of low voter turnout and make your vote count a little bit more. So we're talking to Michael Cassidy. Stick with us. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. This is the Mike Madison Show. We're talking to congressional candidate Michael Cassidy. He is challenging Michael Guest in tomorrow's primary election. Hey, tell me a little bit real quick before we get into issue stuff. What is the mechanism for the election tomorrow? What do you need if you don't have an outright victory? How does the runoff situation work? What's the mechanics there?
So if nobody gets 50% of the vote, if nobody gets more than 50, then it will go to a runoff between the top two vote getters.
Yeah.
And then that runoff will be on June 28th. So 3 weeks from tomorrow.
Oh, wow. So that is quick. Yeah.
Oh, very quick. Very quick. So yeah, just like in Alabama, they had their election, I think 2 weeks ago. And now the Senate election, I know, went to a runoff, and so they're going to have their runoff either next Tuesday or the following Tuesday. So it comes pretty quickly. So that's what happens if there's nobody gets more than 50. If somebody gets more than 50, though, 50 or more, then that's it. That's the ball game. And one reason why this Republican primary is so important, and I really encourage everybody listening out there to make a plan and go out and vote. And if you're voting for me, to call friends and family and have them come out to the polls too, is that whoever wins this Republican primary, just based on the structure of the district, it is such a Republican primary, a Republican district, that whoever wins the primary is almost certainly going to win the general election.
Yeah, it's basically a general election vote tomorrow or in a runoff. Yeah, yeah.
Essentially.
All right. Well, and do you have any idea on numbers of people that generally show up? I mean, this is a good time to run, as far as, you know, sometimes in the big name elections, if you're in a general and a highly contested thing in a presidential year, there's so many people that turn out, the numbers that you need get so high. But how many voters do you need in the 3rd congressional district to push to get a winner over the finish line?
Well, that's all going to depend on the exact turnout. So we in Alabama and Ohio, they had some big primary elections recently that had a governor and a Senate race on the ballot, and they only got something like 20-23% turnout for both. Now, so I would expect, and then looking at the last time that we had a election in Mississippi that in the 3rd district that didn't have a senator or president in the midterm, we had very low turnout, something like in the mid-teens, maybe upper teens. So if we, based on how many registered Republicans we got in the district, I'm guessing that it's probably only going to take something like 30,000 votes to win. And there are already plenty of people, maybe, I don't know, let's say 10,000 or so that were never going to vote for Mr. Guest to begin with at all before any of his votes. But then with some of his votes and some of the outreach that we've done with telling more about his record, telling more about what I want to do, I think we're probably we've cut that gap significantly. And really the last bit is the outreach that my volunteers and I have been doing the last week or two, going out to events, door knocking. And really we only need just a little bit more to take us over the top. I truly believe that we're close. If we're not even there already, But we're working hard, and we're getting the message out. That's what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, I have said for a long time, since I've been on air, that I think the primary weapon against the political class are primaries. People need to stop this idea of complaining about the establishment of the party, and they don't care about us, and the corruption in Washington, D.C., and people do not show up for the primary votes. It's always what's most important. And I know I looked at your platform. I know your four-term limits. I understand that. I feel like that's almost a little lazy. Americans, I mean, Mississippians have got the choice to go out tomorrow and make a change. I mean, they can just go do it. They don't need to wait on Congress, which has been, you know, it was kind of funny. You know, I was around during the Contract with America under Newt Gingrich, and it was just one of the few things in the contract. They never got around to that term limits piece. You know, that was something they ran on. Yeah. So if you're waiting on a bunch of Congress critters to, you know, put a shelf life on their careers, then I think you're kind of, you know, it's pie in the sky. We all might hope it happens, but this is your, people's chance right now. Every time there's a primary, you have a chance to make a change. And also, you know, wrestle control out of the hands of the parties themselves and start voting for individuals. I have also said I'm not a supporter of people sending money to a political party, but instead finding a candidate you can get behind and send them money. Money going to the party, it goes to the party and the, you know, the establishment part of it, unfortunately or unfortunately. Anyway, real quick, let's get into let's get into gun control, then we'll probably have to take a break. But Senator Pat Toomey, one of the lawmakers involved in the ongoing bipartisan gun negotiations, that's already a warning sign there, said the group has to be realistic but hopes at least half of his Republican colleagues in the Senate will vote for a potential deal if one ever arises. Speaking with moderator Margaret Brennan on CBS's Face the Nation, Toomey said he supports legislation that he has sponsored that would expand background checks and encourage states to implement red flag laws, which allow people to petition a court to temporarily confiscate firearms from owners considered risk to themselves or others. So the Republicans themselves are championing red flag laws, and my understanding is the mechanism to, air quotes here in the studio, encourage states is they're going to send out grants to states. I believe Lindsey Graham is a part of this, too, where they would basically bribe states with federal dollars if they enact red flag laws. So where are you on this so-called bipartisan gun negotiations?
So I think that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and that I don't doubt the sincerity of some of these people that want gun control laws, that they think that that is the way to make things better in the country. But it is absolutely wrong. That it is a it's an infringement on our Second Amendment rights. It is a pathway that the left exploits. They're exploiting this tragedy to fulfill what their desire is, which is to eliminate the Second Amendment. Eventually, they don't want it. They're not going to come out and say it. Many of them, at least, some of them are starting to say it.
Yeah, Joe Biden's tiptoeing around it as he's talking about anything nine millimeter or higher. He's kind of laying their cards on the table. He's probably too stupid to realize he's doing it, but he is.
And would we have to what? The establishment Republicans have failed to do time and time again is realize that if you give these people an inch, they're going to take a mile, and that you start doing what seems a lot of people support a red flag law. Why not just do it? Well, then that you put in a red flag law, and then you start banning more types of guns, more types of ammunition. You start saying, hey, you can't have a gun until you're 30 or something like that. Or you've got to be in the military to have a gun, somebody who's had firearms training. And it's just these little ice pit. They're just chipping away. They're just chipping away at our fundamental liberties that our founders, that they were, well, quite literally up in arms over the British, the government, the monarchy, and the colonial governments trying to take firearms away from them. And it's something that we have to be clear-eyed and have a stiff backbone on the right to not to remember, think long-term, and think about the continued rights that we all enjoy as Americans.
Yeah, I think we are so short-sighted. Red flag laws, I'll be honest with you, sound great. Just the idea that there is this There is this way to stop people who may act out and are mentally unstable from having a weapon that could harm other people. Boy, that just really, that kind of hits your, it's one of those things where you go, well, of course we don't want crazy people to own weapons, but the mechanism of red flag laws, which strips Americans of due process, it does not take much of a mental leap to understand the abuses that could be suffered, you know, by people under those kinds of laws.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, good. So we've got a Second Amendment advocate up there. I read a quote earlier. The Libertarian Party put something out. They want to decriminalize machine guns, so you understand where the libertarian mindset is on comes to the Second Amendment. Shall not be infringed is pretty darn clear to me. All right, when we come back, I wanted to get into some other things. I know you've got – I did want to talk border with you. I'm going to bring up a point, see what you think about it. I think the border is a complicated issue, but it's certainly on the top of mind of a lot of people. So we'll talk about border. We're talking to Michael Cassidy. He is congressional candidate for the 3rd Congressional District in Mississippi, running in a primary against Michael Guest tomorrow morning, all day tomorrow. So listen to what he has to say and then make your decisions. We'll be right back.
Well, it would have been, could have been worse than you would ever know. On the dashboard and melted, but we still have the radio.
All right, we are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB. We're talking to Michael Cassidy, challenger to Michael Guest in tomorrow's Republican primary for the 3rd Congressional District. So, we need to hit some stuff. I could talk to you for hours. Let's real quick, the border. This is certainly one of the platforms you're running on. What's your view on border control?
Well, that we have to actually have it, that the Secretary of Homeland Security says that we've got the border under control when a 250,000 people are streaming across the border. That's just false. It's a lie. And it's not just a lie. It's a lie that affects the America, and that's one of the big reasons why I want to impeach both Biden and Harris, is because of their main duty, in my opinion, really Biden's ultimate duty, is the protection of the country and within the Constitution, and that he has completely abandoned that by abandoning the protection of our border. So we got, so what do we do to fix it? So we got to not only just finish building the wall, but what I think about is the things that are most precious to the government, such as places like the White House or our nuclear weapons. What do we do with nuclear weapons? We have big fences, and we got Marines with guns guarding those nukes. And so we ought to think of our nation as similarly, it's not a perfect example, but that we should be protecting our country to control who comes in. And it's one thing if you live in your neighborhood, you don't need Marines with guns protecting your neighborhood if you've got a fine neighborhood and you're not worried about bad people coming in. But if we have a border that does have people that are trafficking, that have sex trafficking going on, people that are bringing in fentanyl that's killing over 100,000 Americans a year, that is something beyond just beyond the illegal immigration aspect of it. There are so many reasons to the potential terrorists coming across the border that I know they've caught some, that we have to, one, build the wall, and then we have to put either a lot more border patrol or we got to put military, temporarily at least, on to make sure that people don't get in. We got to deport the people that are in here illegally already. We either have laws as a nation or we don't. And then I'm in favor of ending birthright citizenship. I think that people that come here that are not Americans at all, and then they have a kid and they just happen to be here, that's a draw for, it's really richer people. Like I've seen, it's called birth tourism, right. That people come here and they can have a kid, pregnant women will come here, have their kid, and then their kid's got American citizenship, and then with like chain migration, you've got that anchor baby. It's literally an anchor baby, the anchor that can bring other members of their family in due time. And we got to end that as an incentive to get people that really aren't Americans in our country. You ought to have at least one American parent to be an American citizen from birth, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, it is. It's frustrating to people, I think, particularly because, you know, in my particular opinion, the government is way too big. It does a ton of things that I find completely unconstitutional. Congress on a daily basis does things I believe are unconstitutional. There's only a few things that the federal government is supposed to be doing, and borders is one of them. I mean, they're really not asked to do very many things, but I think protecting America's borders are one of those things. Now, I'm going to pose something to you that's slightly different than others. I believe there, you know, I look at the illegal immigration across our southern border as being kind of like a tube of toothpaste. We know that the Democrats want to leave the cap off. You know, they're just going to allow open borders to the south. But there's a lot of Republican policies that I see over the years that squeeze the tube from the other end. I've talked about them on this show. One is, and we probably won't have time to get into this, but I sure would sure love to. When you're a candidate or when you're in office, we'll have you back on to talk about it. But one is our endless war on drugs, which has created the cartels, which make all of their money, billions of dollars in black market drugs. You don't have Jose Cuervo running illegal immigrants and doing human trafficking. You don't have Dos Equis running human trafficking rings. One is our war on drugs, and the other is some of the military operations we've used that have propped up dictators in Central and South America that have actually created, you know, horrible places in the in Central America and South America that people sometimes are literally fleeing for their lives. So it seems to me we've got kind of a perfect storm of we've created really failed countries to our south, and then we leave the border open up here. And I don't know, we tackle illegal immigration. A wall will make some difference if it ever gets done, but I don't know you stop that, and also the benefits that we give here. As I say, if you want to keep the moths off your porch, the first thing you do is you turn off your light. So we need to stop the entitlements and stuff too. But I think there are several issues at play. Some of these people are literally running for their lives. Our drug war has created cartels in Mexico and Central America that make living there very dangerous.
I think we can agree that the foreign policy of the State Department, that the foreign policy of a lot of interventionist thinking in both both Democrats and Republicans alike has not been for the benefit of the American people, for one, and then often the nations that we get involved in.
Oh, yeah.
A perfect example is Afghanistan. That I was a kid then, but fully support, even in retrospect, the decision to go into Afghanistan in October of 2001 to root out bin Laden and Al Qaeda. But then what we've done since then is, well, until the last year, was just there is no unified policy. It was simply the rule by bureaucrats, by unelected bureaucrats, with no true mission, no end in sight, but with the effect of devastating the country, causing refugees, and that certainly has a role to play in international migration. No doubt about that.
Yeah. What do you think about this blanket AUMF, this authorization of use of military force that's granted to every president that has got us involved? I mean, we haven't declared war since World War II, yet we are constantly sending troops halfway around the world to fight and die in the sand or in the jungle, and currently in the slog of Afghanistan, we're sending weapons, and I'm sure we've got advisors and things there. What is your view on us just throwing our troops all over the planet?
I think it's horrible. I think that it truly is not in the interests of the American people, and that it is a dereliction of duty from Congress to basically just allow the executive to be to have the essentially the powers of war with just kind of a weak AUMF from Congress. It's something that, you know, even Michael Guest, he voted. There is a vote back in 2020 or 2021 that would have repealed. And I'll be honest, I don't know if it passed or failed, but it would have repealed the AUMF for Iraq. And Guest voted against it. He wanted to keep that going. He wanted to keep the you know, the authorization, basically a blank check for military force around the world. And now there are the threat of the very, there's a very specific threat of terrorism, that I do believe it is good that if we do have truly actionable intelligence, that there really are, like, the next bin Laden, let's say, or somebody that are actively planning terrorist attacks on American interests, either an American interest like our bases or our allies' bases, then that is something that, by all means, that's protecting America. That is a specific, we are acting in the defense of Americans, and we need to, and I'm supportive of that, but the endless wars that, well, fortunately we finally ended in Afghanistan, but both in the amount of money that we're spending, the deaths, not just American, and that's horrible enough, the deaths and the injuries and the trauma to our military people. It is, without a good mission, it's wrong is an understatement. But it's also also other people around the world.
Yes.
We are that, you know, as a Christian, it's not just, even though, yes, I'm America first, but as a Christian, we have compassion for our fellow man around the world, and that we have to consider the effects that we have on people that are not Americans without just, we can't just completely ignore them. Even though we are looking out for our own best interests, we have to also consider our fellow man.
Well, that's also, I can't remember if it was McChrystal or who it was, but it was a general in the Middle East, and he said, you know, it was recounted in, I think, War Machine, the Brad Pitt movie, where he gave a speech where he said, you know, here's the math. You go out and you drop a bomb and you kill 20 supposed suspected terrorists. You know, you drop a bomb on 20 suspected terrorists and 18 die. So how many terrorists do you have left? And, you know, everyone says, well, you got two left. He said, no, now you've got about 50. Yep. Because of those 18 people, their brothers, their sisters, their moms, their dads, their friends are now, hostile to the United States for doing these things. So it's been our presence in the Middle East that has caused a lot of these problems in the first place. But, I think that the other side of that is we have 800 military bases around the planet right now. We have built an empire that we cannot afford. And I, for the life of me, cannot see the benefit to the average American, either in safety to our country, in any national interest. I know whose interest it does serve, and it's not us, but we've got 800 military bases around the world becoming the world's policemen and setting up this empire we cannot afford.
Yeah, I agree that that alone, the affordability that we spend. And one of the things I really liked about Trump that at least he was talking about, I'll be honest, I'm not sure how much actually ended up happening, but talking about getting some of these foreign countries to help pay for the protection that we give them, that it's not, you know, even though there's a stated we get a benefit from it, man, it is, we are putting all of these expenses on a credit card that hasn't come to its limit yet, but it's coming to its limit.
Yeah, it's coming.
We have, for decades, we have acted like, I don't know, like an 18-year-old kid that just got their first credit card without any real financial wisdom.
Well, I actually think it's... I think it's almost worse than that. I think we're acting like parents who have got children and we've decided to take out credit cards in their names. We're going to run up all the debt and then we're going to let them deal with the consequences and pay it off when they get to be older, because we're laying this on our children's head. Out of curiosity, we right now have about a $1 trillion national security apparatus between military budgets, Homeland Security, CIA, NSA. What do you think about that? I mean, America doesn't seem to be able to afford that. I don't believe that those expenditures are done for the interest of the average American. Is there any room to cut military budgets, to use money more wisely, to maybe unwind some of these foreign entanglements that we have that are costing us so much money? Is there any way to reverse that trend?
I think that as somebody who's been in the military for my entire adult life, I'm in the reserves now, but that I have seen tons of waste, and that we need to, just like we need an audit of the Federal Reserve, we need to truly audit the Department of Defense. We need to look at the contracts that we're doing. We need to look at what we need to look for at a long-term. We have to have long-term strategy. That's something that, you know, China's our biggest adversary, but one thing that I have a begrudging respect for China is that they think long-term.
Right.
And that we need to be thinking strategically long-term. And part of that is figuring out what are our expenses that truly contribute to the national security of the United States, and what are the expenses that do not contribute to the national security of the United States. And if it's something that contributes, that, for example, our nuclear weapons, that deterrence, the deterrence of our nuclear weapons, that is something that contributes greatly to our national security, and we got to keep those.
Yeah,
that's just the way the world is with nukes out in the world. But other things, whether we need to have troops in Germany, whether we need to have as many troops in the Pacific, you know, these are things that we have to make. And I don't have the perfect answer of, well, we need to deploy exactly this many battalions and this many ships. But we need to take a much more sober assessment, of what kinds of deployments, what kinds of things are most effective for national security, and what are we need to cut back on, because eventually we're not going to have money to pay for any of it if we don't act wisely now.
Look, we're doing what the Roman Empire did. We've created an empire. It has not served the American people, in my estimation. A lot of people have gotten fabulously wealthy on it, but we are actually creating problems. We are, I think it was it John Adams or Samuel Adams that said we should not be going in search of monsters to destroy, and I think we have ignored that advice, and that's what we've been doing.
Yeah, anyway, John Quincy.
Yeah, John Quincy. Yeah, thank you. All right, well, I got one other question. I'm not letting you off the hook without talking about taxes, so we got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about taxes. We're talking to Michael Cassidy, congressional candidate in the third congressional race that is taking place tomorrow, so make sure that you get out and get those votes going. This is going to be a low turnout one. Your vote can mean a lot in this election. So stick around. We'll be right back. All right, final segment here on the Mike Madison Show, talking to congressional candidate Michael Cassidy. Mike, I got to ask you real quick before we go. Taxes are a big bugaboo of mine. What do you think the level is that the federal government is entitled to of each one of my paychecks, or the average American's paychecks? Is there a percentage amount?
I don't have a specific number for you, but I do believe that the government which taxes least, we should have the minimum taxes required for the function of the core, to have the core functions of the federal government.
Well, I will submit to you that minimum number that should be is zero. I believe the federal income tax of itself is right now, they just released a report. We're poised to take $2.6 trillion out of the pocket of individuals in income tax. And as you said earlier, this is in the face of a government that just prints money. It's not like they need that money to meet some budgetary constraint or something like that to just fill in the gap and do it. At this point, it's just punitive, because they could just print up a little bit more than they have been printing and leave us alone. But I think taxes, you know, I am for an audit and abolishment of the Federal Reserve, which facilitates all of the bad ideas that the right campaigns against. And if you get to Congress, I hope that you will consider using the term Death Star when it comes to the Federal Reserve. I'm trying to get that to catch on. But anyway, all right, we've only got about a minute left. I will give you your last minute here to tell people why they need to come out and give you a vote tomorrow.
All right, thanks, Mike. So as we've mentioned before, the primary election, it's going to determine who wins the general election.
Right.
This is such a Republican district that whoever wins tomorrow, whoever gets the most votes, assuming that we don't go to a runoff, they're going to be the next congressman here. And most people in the country, most people in the state, most people in the district And I'd say most people listening to us right now would agree that most of the people in Washington, D.C. got to go, that we cannot continue with our current representation and think that anything different is going to change.
Exactly.
And one of the guys who has to go is our current Congressman Michael Guest. He has voted for the January 6th Commission, was the only Republican to vote for that, voted to give over $1 billion to Planned Parenthood, over $50 billion to Ukraine. We've got this $30 trillion in debt and rising. And this opportunity tomorrow for y'all is to go out and say no to all this. Say all no right. to the establishment. To give your vote to somebody who's going to fight for us, the American people, and the people of 3rd District.
All right. That's Michael Cassidy. Tomorrow is your day to go out and vote for him. Michael, I appreciate you coming on. Hang on. I'll say goodbye to you off air.
No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now. No matter how